in the pit. His soul was anguished to remain alone in the grave. For some time he wailed after the brothers and implored them not to leave him. Yet he scarcely knew what he cried out. His actual thoughts were not with these mechanical and superficial prayers and lamentations, but far below them, while lower down again were others yet more real, like their undertones and ground basses, so that the whole was like a moving music, perpendicularly composed, which his spirit was occupied in conducting on all three levels. This preoccupation was what caused him to commit the blunder of telling the brethren that he had only told them comparatively modest dreams, considering those others which he had also dreamed. No one in his right senses could even for a moment think that the remark was calculated to soften their hearts, but an absent and preoccupied mind might have done so, and thus it was with Joseph. Much had gone on within him, even since that astonishing and horrible moment when the brethren fell upon him like wolves, and he had looked into their faces distorted by fury and hate, out of the eye which they had not closed at once with their fists. Their faces had been very near to him, while they, with nails and teeth, tore the picture robe from his body. Frightfully near, and the hatred which he had read therein had been the greatest torture and the main cause of the horror he felt at the onslaught. Certainly he had quaked with fear and wept for pain under their blows, but fear and pain were quite permeated with the pity he felt for the torturing hatred which he read in the mask-like faces, dripping with sweat, that rose and fell and were thrust into his own. But pity for a pain, the source of which we must recognize to be ourselves, comes close to being remorse. Reuben's intuition had been quite right. This time Joseph had been so rudely shaken that his eyes were opened, and he saw what he had done, and that he had done it. While he was flung hither and thither among their raging fists, while his robe was torn off, while he lay bound, and during his penitential journey to the well-house, amid all his days of horror, his thoughts had never once stood still. They had not paused upon the frightful present, but sped back over a past in which all this, hidden to his blissful self-conceit, though partly and presumptuously known to it, had been preparing itself the while. My God! The brothers! To what had he brought them? For he did understand that he had brought them to this, through manifold and great mistakes which he had committed in the assumption that everybody loved him more than themselves. This assumption which he believed, and yet did not actually quite believe, but according to which he had always acted, and which had brought him, as he now clearly and distinctly recognized, to the pit. In the brothers' distorted and sweating masks, he had read clearly with his one eye that the premise had gone beyond human power, and over a long period had strained their souls and given them great suffering, until now, at last, the final issue had been reached in this end, so frightful for him, and doubtless for them too. Alas, poor brothers! What must they have borne before in desperation they laid hold on the Father's lamb and actually threw it into the pit? Into what a state had they thereby brought themselves, to say nothing of his own, which was hopeless, as he shudderingly confessed himself? It was not credible that he would hold his tongue if he were restored to his Father. He could never make them believe it. He could not believe it. And so they must leave him in the grave, to perish there. There was nothing else for it. This he saw. Yet wonderful to say, horror at his own impending fate left him room in his soul for pity for his murderers. We know this to be true. Joseph was quite aware, he admitted it to himself openly and honorably as he sat at the bottom of the well, that the unashamed presumption which had been the guiding principle of his life had been a game in which he himself had not seriously believed, nor could have done. That, for one thing, he ought never to have told his brothers his dreams. It had been impossibly and incredibly tactless. He even realized that he had actually known this all the time, and yet he had done it. Why? That he did not know. Apparently, that he might be destroyed. But at the bottom of his heart, Joseph did not believe it. Privately, he was convinced that God looked further than the pit, that he had far-reaching things in mind, as usual, and had his eye upon some distant purpose, in the service of which he, Joseph, had been made to drive the brethren to the uttermost. They were being sacrificed to the future, and he suffered for them, however badly things went with himself. They would send their father the robe, unhappy men, after they had dipped it in the blood of the kid in lieu of his own, and Jacob would be struck to the earth. At the thought, Joseph was moved to start up, to protect his father from the sight, with the only result, of course, that he felt shooting pains through and through him, sank back in his bonds against the stones of the well, and began once more to weep. He had an agony of leisure in which to weep, to feel anguish, remorse, and pity, and despairing of his life, yet in his inmost being to believe in the wise and healing future purposes of God. For frightful as it is to think of it, he was to remain 3 days in the pit, 3 days and nights, in his bonds, naked and exposed, in dirt and earth mould, among crawling worms, without bite or sup, without consolation or any reasonable hope of ever reaching the light again. I, who tell it, must take care that I paint it as it was, that I make clear what it meant for Jacob's little son, who had never imagined that fate could be so harsh. How dismally the hours passed, till his scrap of daylight died in the crack between the stones, and a pitying star sent down its diamond ray into the grave. How the pale dawn twice came, abode, and went again. How he constantly peered up in the twilight at the round walls of his house to see whether there were footholds in the broken wall, or crevices made by pushing roots. But his bonds and the stone well cover, each by itself and certainly together, quenched every hope in the bud. How he twisted himself about in the cords to find an easier posture, which quickly became even worse than the other. How thirst and hunger tortured him, and the emptiness of his stomach gave him burning sensations in his back. How, like the sheep, he soiled himself with his own filth, and therein nestled and shivered till his teeth chattered. I am greatly concerned to give a lively and exact picture of this all-embracing unpleasantness. At the same time, I must be careful to cling to reality, and not let my imagination get the upper hand and lose itself in empty emotion. Reality is sober, precisely in its character as reality. At grips with the actual and undeniable, driven to an understanding with it, reality insists upon our suiting ourselves to the circumstances and adapting us without loss of time. We are easily persuaded to call a situation unbearable. Our easily aroused humanity protests indignantly, and that probably does the sufferer good. But it becomes a little absurd in the face of the really intolerable. The sympathetic friend's relation to this reality, which is of course not his own, is an unreal and sentimental one. He commits an error of the imagination, for the sufferer, thanks to his suffering, is in a different category. What do we really mean by the unbearable, when there is nothing to be done but bear it so long as we are in our senses? But young Joseph had not been entirely and clearly in his senses for a long time, not since the moment when the brethren had turned into wolves before his eyes. The storm which then broke over him had numbed him very much, effecting those palliations which the unbearable needs in order to be born. The beatings he had received had dulled his feeling, as had that unbelievable conveyance into the well. His situation was certainly desperate, but at least it had put a period to those frightful shocks and produced a sort of equilibrium. However objectionable his present state, it had the advantage of security. Buried in the womb of the earth, he needed not to fear further violence, and had time to pursue his laboring thoughts, for these at times almost made him forget his physical sufferings and dangers. And his security, if we may use the word with reference to almost certain death. But why not, since death is at all times certain, and yet we feel secure? His feeling of security, then, inclined him to sleep. His exhaustion was so great that it outweighed all else. He fell asleep, and through long stretches of time knew little or nothing of himself. When he roused, his astonishment at the refreshment which the sleep had brought, for food and sleep can for a while replace each other, mingled with a fresh sense of horror that he was still in the pit and still in misery. Even in sleep he did not entirely lose the sense of misery, but its worst rigors did, as it were, manage to relax a little. The bonds were hard, the cramped position still endured, but even they began to relax. On the second and third days the cords had given way a little, and yielded to the needs of the poor tortured limbs. I say all this, once more, to confront our sympathy with the solid reality of facts. But on the other hand, if I add that Joseph was of course growing weaker all the time, it will serve to keep our pity from quite dying out, even though I must add that his very weakness was an amelioration to his sufferings. From this point of view, one might almost say that the longer his stay in the pit lasted, the more tolerable it was, so that by the end he was scarcely aware of his own misery. But his thoughts worked on and on, the body almost forgotten. It was as though, in the piece of music which we have imagined them to represent, those undertones and basses at the bottom came out stronger and stronger, thanks to that dreamy weakness of his, until at last they almost drowned out the overtones. So long as the brethren were near, the fear of death had been apparent, as expressed in his urgent entreaties and wailings. But now they were gone, and the cries had died away, why was it that Joseph did not shout in hopes of a chance rescue? Because he quite forgot to, absorbed as he was in far other trains of thought, having to do with his abrupt downfall, with the past and its errors, perhaps ordained by God, but not on that account less heavy and grievous. The garment which the brothers had torn off his body, partly with their teeth, shocking to say, played a prominent role in his reflections. That he ought not to have spread himself in it before them, nor made his ownership visible to their eyes. Above all things, that he ought not to have appeared before them in it here and now, came over him so forcibly that he could have beat himself on the head but for his bonds. He did so in spirit, but even so he had to confess to himself the futility and curious hypocrisy of the gesture, for now he saw that he had always understood the whole thing, and yet had so behaved. With amazement he contemplated the riddle of self-destructive arrogance presented to him by his own extraordinary behavior. His wits could not cope with the riddle successfully, nor can anyone's, perhaps because so much of the incalculable is implicit therein, so much that is contrary to reason, and even perhaps holy. How he had trembled lest Jacob discover the ketonet in the bag. Trembled, that is, before his own salvation. He had deceived his father, taken advantage of the old man's failing memory, and packed the ketonet. But not because he had disagreed with his father as to the effect which the sight of the veil would have upon the brothers. He had understood perfectly, and had packed it none the less. How could he have done so? Again, since he had not forgotten to take care for his own destruction, why had Jacob forgotten to prevent it? Another puzzle. Joseph's desire to smuggle the coat could not have been stronger than the father's loving concern that he should leave it at home. Why had not love and anxiety been strong enough to remind the old man, and so to foil Joseph's plan? Joseph had succeeded in beguiling away the rich garment from Jacob's tent. It was partly the effect of the game, partly because Jacob wanted the child to have the robe quite as much as the latter desired it. The consequences followed promptly. Together they had brought the lamp to the pit, and now Jacob would be struck to earth. But after that, he might well be thinking of the mistakes of the past common to them all, just as Joseph was now doing. The boy was honest with himself. He admitted that he had forsworn himself when he said he would say nothing to Jacob if the brothers released him. The promise had been born of fear. Joseph knew that if the old state of things were restored, which with some part of his being he ardently desired, he must unavoidably tell all, and the brethren would suffer the consequences. Restoration was out of the question. But even if it were not, he was in a way at one with the brethren in not wishing for it. He could almost have returned the kiss which Dan had wanted to throw to him in the pit, so much did he feel that for the first time he was really among them as their brother, and might hear all that they said. Might even hear that about the blood of the kid, which should pass for his blood. It did not matter, since he was as good as dead and buried already. A strong impression had been made upon Joseph by what Dan had said, that they might say what they liked before Joseph, since every word they uttered only heightened the impossibility of his return home, and that it was good to utter them, since each one bound him more firmly to the lower world, and made of him more and more a ghost before whom one shudders. Joseph saw in such words the counterpart and inversion of the role which he had played so far in life, that of needing to heed nobody, because all the world loved him more than they did themselves. For it was come to this, that no one heeded him at all. The thought conditioned those undertones and bases of his composition, and the weaker he became, the more did they sonorously predominate over the overtones. But they had begun to play even earlier, at the moment when the undreamed of became reality, when his provocative conduct had called down punishment, and he was tossed to and fro like a toy amongst the brethren, and they had torn the picture robe with their nails and teeth. From that moment on, then, they had been vocal. In the midst of that hail of horrifying blows, his ear had in good part hearkened to them. It would be wrong to suppose that under such deadly serious circumstances Joseph had stopped playing and dreaming. If one may still speak of his activity as playing and dreaming in this connection, he was a true son of Jacob, the man of thoughts and dreams and mystical lore, who always understood what happened to him, who, in all earthly events, looked up to the stars, and always linked his life to God's. Granted that Joseph's way of dignifying his life by attaching it to the higher law and reality was not the same as Jacob's, less spiritual, more shrewdly calculating, yet he seriously held that a life and activity without the hallmark of higher reality, which does not base upon the traditionally sacred and support itself thereupon, nor is able to mirror itself in anything heavenly and recognize itself therein, is no life or activity at all. He was convinced that nothing in the lower world would know how to happen or be thought of without its starry prototype and counterpart, and the great certainty guiding his life was belief in the unity of the dual, in the fact of the revolving sphere, the exchangeability of above and below, one turning into the other, and gods becoming men, and men gods. Not for nothing was he the pupil of old Eliezer, who knew how to say I in such an ample way that Joseph's eyes grew dim with musing as he beheld him. The transparency of being, the characteristic recurrence of the prototype, this fundamental creed was in his flesh and blood too, and all spiritual dignity and significance seemed to him bound up with awareness of it. That was as it should be. What was, after all, not quite as it should be, but seemed more like a degenerate deviation from the significant and admirable type, was Joseph's inclination to draw advantage from the general prepossession in his favor, and consciously to impose himself upon those about him. From the first moment on, he was aware of all this. Incredible as it may seem, in the thick of the turmoil, in the acutest moment of fear and danger of death, he had kept his mental eye open to realities. Not that fear and danger grew less thereby, but he actually experienced a sort of joy as well. The pleasure of enlightenment, almost like the relief which laughter brings, had illuminated the dark terror in his soul. "My coat!" he had cried out in the anguish of his concern. "Tear it not, I pray you!" Yes, they had rent it in pieces and torn it off him. That was his mother's robe, and that belonged also to her son, so that they wore it by turns, and became one, and god and goddess by its means. Mercilessly had the brethren unveiled him. As love unveils the bride in the bedchamber, thus had their fury done to him, and they had known him naked, so that his frame quivered with the deathly shame. In his mind, thoughts of unveiling and of death dwelt close together. How could he then have helped holding the rags of the garment round him in his fright, begging them to tear it not? Yet no more could he have helped being filled with the joy of understanding, coming to him through association of thought, through the conviction of repetition and realization. No danger of the flesh and the soul could prevent the concentration of his spirit upon the wealth of allusion by which the event proclaimed itself as higher reality, as a transparency of the ancient pattern, as the uppermost turning undermost, in short, as written in the stars. And his concentration was very natural, as the allusions all had to do with being and selfhood, with the vista of his ego, which he had opened to Reuben a little time ago, to the latter's amaze, and which now was growing brighter and brighter. He had wept and wailed when big Reuben had given his voice that they should throw him into the pit, yet at the same time his reason had laughed as at a joke. The word used was so laden with allusions. "Bore," the brothers had said, and the monosyllable was capable of various interpretations. It meant not only well, but prison. Not only prison, but the underworld, the kingdom of the dead. So that prison and the underworld were one and the same thought, one being only a word for the other. Again, the well in its property as entrance to the underworld, likewise the round stone which covered it, signified death. For the stone covered the round opening as the shadow covers the dark moon. In Joseph's mind, the primeval prototype of the death of the planet peeped through the present event. The dead moon, which is invisible for 3 days until its new birth, means the death of the gods of light, who must for a time descend to the underworld. When the horror happened, and the brothers hoisted him onto the edge of the well and on the margin of the pit, so that he must descend below the daylight with all the caution he could muster, then his quick mind had clearly understood the allegory of the star, which one evening is a woman, and in the morning a man, and which sinks into the well of the abyss as evening star. It was the abyss into which the true son descends, he who is one with the mother, and wears the robe by turns with her. It was the nether earthly sheepfold, Etura, the kingdom of the dead, where the son becomes the Lord, the shepherd, the sacrifice, the mangled god. Mangled? They had torn only his lips and his skin here and there. But the robe they had torn off and rent with nails and teeth, those red murderers and conspirators, his brothers, and they would dip it in the blood of a kid, which should pass for his blood, and they would bring it before the Father. God demanded from the Father the sacrifice of the Son, for the soft-hearted one, who, shuddering, had confessed that he could not do it. Poor man! He would have to do it. And it was like God that he paid little heed to what man thinks he can do.